Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're concluding our study in 2 Samuel. I hope it's been an interesting time for you as we looked at the life of David, the beginnings of the monarchy, United Monarchy. This chapter today has some extremely interesting aspects to it that I think are going to be fruitful for all of our lives. This chapter is going to picture, well, really this appendix back to chapter 21 through 24 is kind of an appendix that we're not sure exactly of the chronological relationship of these four chapters to what previously occurred in the life of David. David is pictured as saint, sinner, saint. We see his victories, we see his moral failures. Throughout this chapter is going to come through the character, the gracious character of God, and David's, not his sinlessness, but his willingness to repent, to turn back and trust God. And that's going to be the key throughout here. 2 Samuel 24 is repeated in 1 Chronicles 21. The relationship between Samuel and Chronicles is much like the relationship between the Synoptic Gospels and John. Chronicles was written much later for a different theological purpose. In Samuel and Kings, the sin of the kings, including David and Solomon, is portrayed. In Chronicles, the sin is somehow glossed over. Well, in this chapter, it begins with David sinning. That makes a very interesting relationship. 1 Chronicles has some additions that 2 Samuel 24 doesn't have. There's some manuscript problems here. There's obviously a discrepancy in the parallel account. Some of this we're not going to be able to explain, and we're not going to know which is the original text in some cases. Now, what's interesting is when you compare chapter 24, verse 1, with 1 Chronicles 21, 1, in Samuel it says, "Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say." But in 1 Chronicles it says, "Satan incited David." So here we have what looks like an obvious contradiction, that God incited David to do this, or Satan incited David to do this, and that seems so contradictory. But in reality, that's pretty much biblically complementary, and it runs like this. If you go back to the introduction of Job, Satan is God's instrument of offering man an alternative. Satan is that creation of God that challenges the boastful righteousness of man. Therefore, Satan cannot do anything without God's permission. I think we have to say that in a world created by one God, that everything has to be in God's will in some sense. God uses Satan, but God does not institute evil. Now, the other thing I would say to you is, in 1 Chronicles 1, it does not say the Satan, which makes it a title. In Hebrew, it means the adversary. But it's a Satan, or an adversary. We can see this is used many times in a sense that it's not a personal form of evil or not a personal archangel. And you might want to see 1 Kings 11:14, where it says God sent an adversary against Solomon. And it's obviously not the personal force of evil Satan at all. And so I think we have to take all of this into account. You might also want to look at 2 Samuel 19:22. Where the same idea of an adversary, but not the evil one necessarily, is used. I do believe in a personal evil, but I also believe that many times other problems in life are characterized by this same term, an adversary, when it speaks of human instrumentality used for God's purposes. In a sense, that's what Pharaoh was in the Exodus, a human adversary. And sometimes the Bible does not make a distinction. I believe in a personal force of evil, but sometimes in the Bible it's spoken of as God's actions in his world. Everything exists in the will of God, or it wouldn't exist. Satan exists in the will of God. Now, by the way, in this chapter, not only does God seem to control this adversary, he also controls the death angel. That shows you God is in control of all things. He's in control of death. He's in control of problems. Now, the purpose of problems is the key. The problems aren't the problem. It's how we handle the problems. If we allow the problems to destroy us, to cause us to stumble, as they did David, you can obviously say Satan. If the problems are used as a stepping stone to greater faith and trustfulness, then you can see how God uses this testing and problems. The Bible can speak, like in Amos, I believe it's 3:16, that God sends evil. But we have to remember the evil that God sends is for two purposes. Number one, to cause us to repent and turn back to Him, or to strengthen us in our faith. And I think when we see that perspective, that God uses the evil one for good purposes, then something of the fog of the problems and crisis of this life clears up. I want to say that nothing just happens to God's kids. Amen? And again, now some say the again here, verse 1, links chapter 24 back to chapter 21, where God's anger burned against Israel on that account too. Now notice the anger of the Lord. It would be unfortunate for us to say, only talk about God's love. God is also angry. He is saddened by the way His world treats itself, and God acts in His world to bring about something better. And I think that's very important. Burned against Israel. Notice it wasn't against David, it was against Israel. And so therefore, when David sees that his sin is going to impact his nation, he feels very responsible. But the truth is, it was the nation that God was trying to reach. And the means He used to punish Israel was David's personal choice. Now, David's responsible for his own acts. He can't blame God, predestination. He can't blame Satan. David is responsible for his own acts, and so are you and I. We do have the pull of God. We do have the pull of the evil one, but we are responsible for our own acts. To incite David, and the deal here is to number Israel. Now, why is that a problem? Some have said that this idea of the numbering of the people has always had a kind of a spiritual negative attached to it. And you might want to see Exodus chapter 30, verse 11 and 12. There may be an element of truth there. But there are two numberings in Numbers where nothing evil is really spoken of about the numbering of the people. It was done for military purposes. It was done for a land allocation later on. Some say here it's done for taxation. But it looks like to me in this chapter, it's because it's fighting men, it's got to be for military purposes. Some would say that what happened here is David is becoming prideful over his victories. That he is saying, look at all my men, look at all my resources, look at all what I've done. And it's this incipient pride that God's going to nip in the bud in this man whom he loves so well. And I think even Joab, verse 3, is going to sense something spiritually not right here. Joab is not known for his spirituality in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel. And yet even Joab senses this is not the will of God. So they're going to number Israel. And the king said to Joab, the commander of the army, this is a very strange little phrase here, the captain of the host. It's usually used for an angel. It's a strange reflection here, but it does show that the Lord of hosts is a military term of the captain of the armies of heaven. He was to go and register the people. Verse 9 pretty much shows us it was for military purposes. And Joab said to the king, may Yahweh your God, your Elohim, add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of the king still see. Now what Joab is saying is, David, my prayer is that God will multiply your army, multiply your kingdom. But David, don't count them. Counting them kind of makes you trust in the numbers instead of trusting in God. David, I hope God blesses you, but don't do this. But of course, as you know, David did it. You might want to see the parallel in 1 Chronicles 21:3, where it says this numbering caused guilt. And Joab recognized there was a sin, there was a problem connected to it. Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed, and Joab went out with all the army in the presence of the king. Now, in verses 5 through 8, it's kind of a geographical movement of these census takers. It seems to begin on the west bank of the Jordan. We call it the Transjordan, starting from about midway up, a little bit north of the Sea of Galilee. It moved all the way through the land of Gilead. It moved over to the east bank of Jordan, somewhere around the city of Dan, maybe a little bit north of that, and moved southward. And we're going to see from the parallel in 1 Chronicles chapter 21 that Joab had not finished the count, either because he was nervous about it or because he hadn't moved that far south. And so the Benjamites and the Levites are not going to be counted. Judah and Israel, even at this early stage, already seem to be two administrative districts of the United Monarchy. Now, and you can see that in verse 9. There's a couple of problems here, and I'll go over a couple of them with you. Notice in verse 6, my New American Standard says, the land of Tandim Hadeshi. Well, that's it. No one knows where that is. No one's ever seen that word. What in the world is that? Well, that's what the Masoretic text has. But some other possibilities are the Septuagint has Kadesh on Orontes, which is a river to the north. And another possible manuscript variation, which the NIV modern translation follows, is Kadesh in the land of the Hittites, which that river would be up to the north, even of Lebanon. And so some say it's this Kadesh, which would be a corruption of this last name, and you might want to see the different possibilities of that. We're just not sure. Now, it mentions the numbers here in verse 9, and there has been a lot of problems about that because the numbers disagree from 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21. One number is higher in 2 Samuel, and one number is lower, and there's been a lot of confusion. Some say that if you add in Benjamin, who was left out, that you get the same number. We're just not sure why the numbers are different. Now, if we take these numbers literally, 800,000 and 500,000, if these are fighting men only, a fighting age, then the population of Palestine, at least the United Monarchy, is between 4 and 5 million people. And that's a lot of folks. That's quite a significant rise from Joshua's time. But many of us believe the word thousand can be used of several things besides the literal number thousand. It can be used of a tribal group, and it can be used of a military unit. And we think in this particular time it may be a military unit and not a literal thousand. But again, notice that already Judah and Israel are separate in their numbers, and I think that's interesting. Okay. Look at verse 10. And David's heart troubled him. Oh, you can see something of the kind of man David was. Yes, he was tempted by whatever source. Ultimately, he allowed that temptation to fester. He allowed that what I think is pride to develop. And now he senses that he's done something wrong. I think it's the indwelling spirit that does that. This same phrase is used of his sin with Bathsheba back in 1 Samuel, I believe it's 24:5. Now, I think this is showing, number one, that David is a man of like passions like we are. He's a sinful person, and he sins over and over. Well, how can David be God, one of God's favorites, a man after God's own heart? Because David knows how to deal with these things. He sins terribly, but he always throws himself on the mercy and grace of God. He trusts in God's grace, not in his own actions, positively or negatively. Doesn't mean he doesn't sin, but he knows what to do. His heart troubled him after he had numbered the people, and so David said to the Lord, Yahweh, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have acted very foolishly. Notice he does not give any reason for God to act except God's graciousness. Doesn't try to make excuses. Admits his own fault. And let me continue. When David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad. Now Gad has been a prophet from the very earliest times of David fleeing from Saul. You might want to go back to 1 Samuel 23:3-5. He's called David's seer here, which is another name for prophet. There's been a transition in Samuel between God speaking to the high priest and God speaking to the prophets. And so here we have this prophet. And he said, go and speak to David. Thus says the Lord, I am offering you three things. Now, all of these seem to come from Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 27 and 28 are the cursing and blessing section where Moses told Israel if they would keep the law, God would bless them. If they broke the law, God would curse them, just as he did the Egyptians. And, of course, you know this was reaffirmed by Joshua when they entered the Promised Land, and it explains much of the problems of Israel because they never kept the law. So these three plagues are going to come upon, plagues in the sense of three things that are common disasters connected with God's anger and men's sin. Now, here they are, famine, sword, and pestilence. These are connected quite often with how God deals with Israel. Notice these lists. Jeremiah 14:12, Jeremiah 15:2, Jeremiah 21, verses 7 and 9, Jeremiah 24:10, Jeremiah 27:8, Ezekiel 5:12, and Ezekiel 6:12. And if you'll read these three things, David had to choose one. One's going to involve famine, one's going to involve sword, people chasing him, and one's going to involve a plague or pestilence. Now, my Bible says in verse 13, 7 years of famine. But from 1 Chronicles 21, verse 13, it says 3 years. And it seems that Chronicles has preserved a text that seems more in balance with the 3 months and the 3 days of the other two choices. So most translations now pick 3 years out of the parallel in Chronicles 21 than the 7 years here. Now in verse 14, of these three choices, a three-year famine, a three-month David being chased by his enemies, or 3 days of plague, David does this. He says, I am in distress. Now, my Bible says, let us now fall into the hand of the Lord. But the Septuagint says, let me fall into the hand of the Lord. And that seems best because in the end of this verse, he talks about him falling in the hand of the Lord. So I think that the me is better than us. For his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. What he's basically doing is ruling out option number two. He's saying, I don't know if God's going to pick the three-year famine or the three-day plague, but I'm going to trust God because God is so gracious and loving that I have a better chance with God than I do with men. Boy, I believe that. God's much more forgiving than men, much more gracious. I think David knew that judgment, though God does it, is something he does not feel comfortable with. Matter of fact, a beautiful passage in Isaiah 28:21 says that judgment is God's strange work. David threw himself on the mercy and love of God. Friends, that's where ultimately you all have to go because we're all sinful. David made a smart move. So the Lord sent a pestilence. Now, this is seems to be the last option. It's going to be a plague, but it's a supernatural plague. No illness we know kills this many people this quick. It seemed to happen in 1 day, maybe less than just a few hours. We're not real sure about the time frame, but so many are going to die that it does have natural symptoms, but it's caused by a supernatural agent. I've always been interested in the New Testament that demon possession sometimes causes physical illness. But in the Bible, there's always a distinction made between demon possession, which causes a symptom of physical illness, and physical illness. Not all physical illness is caused by an evil spirit. But sometimes it looks the same. This is going to be called by a servant of God, the death angel. That's not the same as Satan. It's another angel. Upon Israel from morning until the appointed time. Now, you would think the appointed time, literally it's an appointed time, would refer to this three-day limit mentioned in two verses earlier. But several of the ancient translations, including the Septuagint and the early Syriac, we call the Peshitta, it has till the noon hour or the noon meal. And the Vulgate adds 3 hours to that and says till the evening sacrifice, which is 3 o'clock. So it seems between 3 hours and 6 hours, if we take the versions, and it may be the 3 days, the full 3 days, but God's going to stop this angel in the midst of his task because of God's love. And so the appointed time, we're not sure. Now, my Bible has 70,000 men. That number comes from the parallel in 1 Chronicles 21:14 and from the Septuagint, because the Masoretic text has 77,000 here. Now you say, well, usually our Bibles follow the Masoretic text. That's true. But when the parallel in Chronicles and the Septuagint seem to back up the lower number, the rounder number, most modern translations take that rounder number, 70,000. It's quite a few people. Matter of fact, that's more than died in any other plague. We've got Korah's rebellion in Numbers 16:49, where 14,700 die. We also have the plague because of the fertility worship of the Baal of Peor on the plains of Moab, and that's in Numbers 25:9, and 24,000 die then. So by far, this is the worst plague to ever hit Israel. Men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. Now, of course, this is a way of talking about the whole promised land from the very farthest north city to the very, very south. And so all through the land, these people were dying. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem. Now, of course, this is the death angel. You may want to see Exodus 12:23 and 2 Kings 19:35 for an explanation about this death angel. There are several times in the book of Exodus where it says the death angel, but it seems to be speaking about God himself. You might want to see Exodus 11:4 and Exodus 12:12 and 13. And what I mean to say by this is, though the death angel is the one that does it, God's the one that sends him, so sometimes God is identified with the work of the death angel. Folks, that's exactly what the deal is. God is the one that allows Satan to do it. He's the one that uses Satan's evil work for good and glory. So sometimes, though Satan's the one that does it, God can be identified with what Satan does. That's why I think verse 1 seems to be so controversial, but when you see the big picture, it's not so controversial. Now, The Lord relented from the calamity. Now, this God relenting is interesting. It's the word repent. God repented. God changed his mind. God relented. God had mercy and stopped right in the middle of the judgment. You might want to see Exodus 32:14. You might want to see Psalms 106:45. Beautiful, beautiful. You might want to see 1 Samuel 15:11 here. For God relented. He changed his mind. He didn't do all that he said he was. When the death angel came to Jerusalem. Now, 1 Chronicles 21 adds quite a bit here that David saw the angel of the Lord standing between heaven and earth with a sword in his hand over Jerusalem. And so it's interesting that it's different. Now, you've got to remember that the account in 1 Chronicles and the account in 2 Samuel are different. 2 Samuel is describing David's sin that allowed God to judge the people because of their sin. But in Chronicles, which does not talk about the sin of David or Solomon or any other kings of Judah, this is going to be the way that God shows David where to build the temple. And this is the place where this death angel stops, is a certain place, a certain mountain close to the city of the Jebusites. And where this death angel stops is where David is going to be told to build an altar. And this site is going to be where the temple will later be built. So you see, the theological purposes are different from 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. And there's more information in Chronicles, usually. Okay, let's see. The angel who destroyed the people of God, and we've talked about that angel. I want you to know that means that death is in the hands of God and not in the hands of the evil one. There is no grim reaper. We can trust our lives and our death to the God of mercy. Hope we remember that. And David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking down the people. Wow. You might want to see a fuller account of this is in 1 Chronicles 21:16. And this same account in Chronicles 21:16 is also found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's also found in Josephus, Flavius Josephus. So that means there was another ancient manuscript that was different from the Masoretic text that we follow. The Dead Sea Scrolls have showed us that the Septuagint has some variations that may be as ancient and original as the manuscript we usually follow. And I also was thinking this when he saw the angel. This reminds me so much of 2 Kings 6. Where Elisha prayed for his servant that his eyes would be open, and he saw the horses and chariots of God all around the Syrian army. Friends, I believe there is a presence of the supernatural in our world if we could just see the presence of angels. I know they're with us. You'll see Matthew 18 again. And he said, "Behold, it is I who have sinned. It is I who have done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let thy hand be against me and against my father's house." This is David's intercessory prayer. This is David admitting his responsibility, though we learn from verse 1 the people were responsible, in a sense, for this problem. I think this is David seeing that his sin affected the people of God. Now, this is very important. Adam's sin affected all mankind. Achan's sin of Joshua 7 affected all the Israeli army. David's sin affected the whole people of God. This is the Old Testament Hebrew concept of corporality, which those of us in the United States are so ignorant of because we've emphasized culturally individualism so much. I want to say there is a sense in which our kids are affected by our faith. You ought to see 1 Corinthians 7 again. I think there's a sense in which we are responsible for our society's sins. Yes, there is a sense of corporality. We're responsible for what our church does as a whole. And if we could just catch that, David sensed that his sin had an impact on many more people. And that's true of our lives. When we allow our testimony to be destroyed, when we do things that we know will hurt other people, I want you to know we're spiritually responsible for the damage that our lifestyle does to others. So, in verse 18, Gad came to David that day and said to him, "Go and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor." Now, there's a name here of a Jebusite person. It's obviously not a Hebrew name. In 1 Chronicles, it's a different name. But maybe the spelling is different because the consonants are pretty close together. This seems to be the site of the plague ceasing is why God had him offer a sacrifice here. But as we learn from 2 Chronicles 22:2 and 2 Chronicles 3:1, this is exactly the site. We think it's Mount Moriah, the place where Abraham offered Isaac. But that's not mentioned here. It's the place where the plague stopped. And God seems to be pointing this out to David as a special place, a reverent place, a place of expiation and propitiation, a place where God meets man in forgiveness. It's going to become a very special site. But it belongs to a Jebusite person here. Now, by the way, 1 Chronicles 21:20 in verse 19 says that this man and his sons also saw the angel, but that's somewhat doubtful. This man saw the king coming and said, "What can I do for you?" And the king said, "I want to build an altar here." And the man said, "Go ahead and do it. And even use the oxen that I've been using to thresh the grain. Use them." And David said, "No, I can't do that. I need to pay you for it. You can't give a sacrifice out of someone else's possessions. I want to pay you for it." Now, down here in verse 24, it says 50 shekels of silver. This is a bad contradiction with 1 Chronicles 21:25, where it says 600 shekels of gold. Woo! Rashi, a commentator from the Middle Ages, Jewish commentator, says that it was that the way you bring these two together, correlate them, it was supposed to be 50 shekels of silver for each of the 12 tribes. Other commentators say no, that all David wanted to do was buy these two oxen to sacrifice and just kind of lease this threshing floor, or maybe just buy this threshing floor only. And later on, the whole area, the whole top of the mountain had to be bought for Solomon's temple. One represents the threshing floor and the oxen only. The other represents the whole area. That may be true. We're just not certain. I'm surprised in verse 25 there's not a sin offering offered, because that's the whole problem with sin. But there's a peace offering and a burnt offering. The burnt offering is total dedication. The peace offering is a fellowship meal. Things with God are back in place. And God has even revealed something tremendously important for the future. So David, the saint sinner saint, has shown us what to do when we're like that. And the great God of mercy has shown the kind of God he is that will always come across for us. This chapter is very significant in its truth about how God uses Satan and how we as sinners should throw ourselves on the mercy of God, for he always loves us. Sin always runs its course. It always hurts people, but he'll never forsake us and never leave us. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. See you same time, same place next week.